Adventures in Research.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? And welcome to another in the series of weekly programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here, ready to take us adventuring, is Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone.
Well, Dr. Thomas, this is the day you promised to tell us more about the story of Eyes and Ears for the Millions, the story of telegraph, telephone, radio, and television.
That's right, Mr. Shannon. We've already told the story of the first regularly scheduled broadcast of November 2nd, 1920, over the newborn radio station, KDKA, nursed into being by Dr. Frank Conrad, and thus turning what had been a dream into a reality, harnessing the swift, invisible energy, electricity, for communication.
Yes, and where do we go from there, Dr. Thomas?
Well, behind the triumph of that day lay a century of brilliant achievement. Men had always dreamed of using electricity to span space with words and messages, even before they knew what an electric cell or generator looked like.
That old urge, curiosity.
Yes, but curiosity with a definite purpose and goal. It was late in October of 1832 when Samuel F.B. Morse, a well-known painter, returned to America after a few years of study abroad. On the home voyage, Morse had caught the bug. After talking with a learned professor on the newly discovered wonders of electricity.
Yes, there are a great many things, amazing, wonderful things, that will come out of this new discovery. I could wish that I were 20, no, 30 years younger, so that I might help in the development of this wonder, electricity.
The story you have told of this new power kindles the imagination, sir. Why, there are no limits to the possibilities.
I can almost see the wheels of your eager imagination turning in your head, Mr. Morse. But what are you thinking?
I was just thinking this new strange power might be used, as you said, for many things like sending messages. Well, thank you, Professor. And now, if you'll excuse me, I must put some thoughts on paper before I forget.
Ah, youth and imagination. Who can stop them in their progress? My word, time for lunch.
Samuel Morse had plans for his telegraph when he left the ship, but 12 years of hard work, experimentation, and disappointment were to follow before he could perfect his device and prove it to a doubting world.
12 years is a long time to devote to one thing, and just an idea on paper at that.
Yes, it is, but a very brief period of time as compared to the countless men of science and others who have devoted a whole lifetime to one idea or cause and never lived to see the final results of their work.
Yes, I see what you mean, Dr. Thomas. They supply the idea in the first place, work on it without too much success, and others come along and put the finishing touch to it, and there it is.
Exactly. Ours is an impatient world which is not too much concerned with names and personalities, but which wishes only to see the results of their labors. This it is thus it has ever been with pioneers. Well, to get back to our story, it was on May 24, 1844, that Samuel Morse sat in the Supreme Courtroom of the nation's capital, surrounded by the statesmen who had finally been persuaded to help him. In Baltimore, at the other end of the first real telegraph line, was Alfred Vail, the young man who had worked for years with Morse to help him develop his instrument.
The chair recognizes Samuel Morse.
Gentlemen, there's little I wish to say at this time. I propose to let this instrument I have brought with me speak for me. My assistant, Alfred Vail, is at this moment seated before another instrument, similar to the one I have here, in Baltimore, Maryland. I shall send him a message by telegraph, which he will repeat as soon as he receives it. Now, gentlemen, I ask that there be absolute silence during this experiment, please. Thank you.
Yes, as the astonished statesmen listened, their doubts vanishing, the message sent by Samuel Morse in Washington to Alfred Vail in Baltimore was repeated, word for word. What hath God wrought? The first great long-distance message sent by electricity.
That must have been a mighty proud day for those two, Dr. Thomas, and for everyone connected with that first telegraph.
Yes, and an exciting day for history, too, Mr. Shannon.
I can imagine. What was Morse's invention like?
It was based on a principle almost every schoolboy knows today, the principle of electromagnetism.
Mm-hmm.
When an electric current flows through a wire, it creates a magnetic field around the wire.
Yes.
If the wire is wound around a soft iron bar, the magnetic field about the wire is concentrated in the iron, making the iron a strong magnet as long as the current continues to flow.
I see. Well, what happens when the current stops flowing?
As soon as the current stops, the iron loses its magnetism. Such a magnet is called an electromagnet.
Well, what kind of a telegraph key did Morse use, Dr. Thomas?
His key was nothing more than a switch which opened and closed an electric circuit at the touch of a finger. At the receiving end, this current ran through the coils of an electromagnet, whose force could be used in a number of ways, so that the pinpoint made a mark on a moving tape, or it could be recorded on the moving tape, or it could attract a bar of metal which clicked down when current flowed through the electromagnet and sprang back when the current stopped.
Must have taken a lot of brains and engineering ability to figure that out, I'd say.
Indeed, yes.
Well, what about the code they used, Dr. Thomas?
The code was one that was worked out by Morse and Vail. The code representing letters and numbers by dots and dashes. So that it was a simple matter for a person receiving the message to interpret the clicks or the long and short lines on the moving tape. Morse's code is still in use today in modern telegraphy.
Yes, I remember learning the Morse code when I was a Boy Scout. At home, my brother and I used to practice tapping out messages to each other on the tables, the chairs, and anything else that would make a noise, especially at mealtimes.
That was probably as easy a way as any to say, pass the butter, without saying please.
Yes, it was.
Well, getting along with our story here. About 20 years or so after Morse and Vail sent their epoch-making message, a British physicist and mathematician published an essay that caused some excitement in high scientific circles.
I say, this is the most extraordinary thing I ever heard. Just listen to this. I am convinced that there must exist electric impulses just like light waves, but of a different length. And then he goes on to say, there are probably other waves longer than light waves which cannot be detected by the eyes. In every other respect, the waves are exactly the same as light waves. That's extraordinary. A very nice theory, of course, but after all, it's only on paper.
What does all that mean, Dr. Thomas?
Well, this British physicist was James Clerk Maxwell, who had done a little mathematical figuring. Mm-hmm. It seemed to him, as his essay read, that there must exist electric impulses just like light waves, but of different lengths.
Yes.
Now, light waves, as we know them today, are electromagnetic radiations, which travel through space at the rate of 186,000 miles a second. The waves are very short, ranging in length from the tiny violet light waves, about 16 millionths of 1 inch long, to the somewhat longer waves of red light, 26 millionths long.
Gosh, I can't even imagine anything that short. Well, Dr. Thomas, what did that remark mean? A very nice theory, of course, but only on paper.
Well, you see, there seemed to be no way of proving it except by intricate mathematical calculations.
And was it proved?
Well, patience, Miss Shannon. We have to move along now to the year 1887, when a youthful physics professor at a high school in Karlsruhe, in Germany, Heinrich Rudolf Hertz, told the world of some amazing experiments that he had been performing for the past 2 years. Experiments that showed beyond the shadow of a doubt that James Clerk Maxwell's figuring was correct.
Good. Then it was proved after all, even though it was much later. Heinrich Rudolf Hertz. That name is very familiar to me, Dr. Thomas.
It should be, Miss Shannon. Hertz is called by many the father of radio. In fact, radio waves are often referred to as Hertzian waves.
Oh, sure. That's right. Well, what kind of experiments was he performing?
Well, briefly, he discovered that when he made a spark leap across a gap in an electrical circuit, he produced electromagnetic waves like the ones Maxwell had predicted.
How did he discover them?
To detect the waves, Hertz used a small hoop of wire which held two balls of metal a short distance apart.
Yes?
The waves from the spark made another electric spark jump almost instantaneously between these two metal balls, mm-hmm. you see? Mm-hmm. With this simple apparatus, Hertz was able to prove everything that Maxwell said. He showed that the waves traveled through space with the same speed as light, mm-hmm. and that they could be reflected or bent, just like light. But more than that, he opened the door to the possibility of sending messages electrically, without wire.
Hmm. And in a way, it proves what you were saying, Dr. Thomas, about one man devoting his life to an idea or a theory, and another man finishing it.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Well, what happened after Hertz made his experiment announcement?
A great many things. By 1895, many great men were hot in pursuit of capturing these waves that Hertz had described. One in particular was not very widely known, for he was only a young man of about 21, the son of a wealthy Italian banker.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1895, this young man, Guglielmo Marconi, was launching an experiment which was destined to grow into an enormous contribution to the world.
Marconi, wireless telegraphy.
Yes, the two are synonymous today. But back in 1895, they were not so well known, Mr. Shannon. And very few persons even knew about Marconi's experiments at that time.
What kind of experiments were they, Dr. Thomas?
Well, in his father's garden, outside the city of Bologna, young Marconi had rigged up a spark gap similar to the one Heinrich Hertz had used in his experiments.
Mm-hmm.
But leading from this gap were two wires, one buried in the ground and the other carried high aloft in the air.
Yes.
Marconi was experimenting with antennas and proving to himself that with the proper antenna, a message could be sent over long distances.
Hmm.
That same year, 1895, he succeeded in sending a message to his father a mile away.
That was progress, all right.
Yes, but he wasn't satisfied. He dreamed of sending a message across the ocean.
That sounds just like a scientist. To get something to the point where it will work, then tear it down and build it up again so it works even better than it was at first hoped for. Never satisfied.
Isn't it, though? Just the same, that's what makes for progress, Mr. Shannon, particularly in this electrical age of ours. A device has to be as near perfect as is humanly possible before it can be marketed.
Yes, I get your point, Dr. Thomas. Well, what happened next to Marconi and his experiments?
From his father's garden in Italy, Marconi moved to England for further experimentation. Bit by bit, he lengthened the stride of his messages, until finally, in December of 1901, he was ready for the great test.
You mean the sending of a message across the ocean, as he'd dreamed?
That's right. In Purldew, England, Marconi had set up a powerful sending station with receiving equipment in an old watchtower overlooking the harbor of St. John's, Newfoundland. On December 12th, all was in readiness to forge another vital link in the chain of communication.
And an exciting link it was, too, I imagine, Dr. Thomas. Gosh, I've been so interested in your story that I hadn't noticed how the time was flying. Can we tell the story of that experiment next week?
We certainly can, Mr. Shannon. You'll find it a most interesting one, I promise you.
All right, and thank you, Dr. Thomas. That's a date for next week, then. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another in the series of programs titled Adventures in Research. Your guide along these adventurous highways and byways of science, telling the story of our various communications and their history, under the title Eyes and Ears for the Millions, was Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The story of how our modern communication systems came into being is told in both words and pictures in the free booklet issued by the Westinghouse Research Laboratories under the title Eyes and Ears for the Millions. You may obtain a free copy by writing to the station to which you are now listening. And be sure to join us again next week when Dr. Thomas will tell the story of Marconi's great experiment with wireless telegraphy on Adventures in Research.